Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 442. My name is Minter Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com. I'd also like to give a shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review of the show to Storywork, who put up his review on Apple Podcasts. This week's interview is with Becky Hall. Becky is a systemic executive coach, facilitator, speaker, and now author of the new book, The Art of Enough, 7 Ways to Build a Balanced Life and a Flourishing World. In this conversation with Becky, we discuss why and how to broker a life that is enough, bearing down on the biggest challenges of our age, finding the path between excess and scarcity, why you should start a no journal, and much more. You'll find all the show notes on minterdial.com. Please do consider dropping your rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show with Becky. Becky Hall, how lovely to have you on my show. I spotted you in my theme, my thread on LinkedIn. I saw you had this new book, The Art of Enough. I pounced on you and you were kind enough to come on my show. In your own words, Becky, how would you like to describe who you are?
Well, hey, Minter, and I'm delighted to be on your podcast. Thank you for inviting me. So I'm Becky Hall. I am a coach and facilitator. So I work with people, usually in leadership positions across different sectors, and I've been doing that for about 20 years. And I sometimes work with teams too. And I've just written a book, so I can also now say I'm an author, which is a lovely thing to be able to say. Yeah.
Yeah. So The Art of Enough, 7 Ways to Build a Balanced Life and a Flourishing World. Tell us your relationship with the word enough. When did it sort of become a beacon for Becky Hall?
Great question. So about 7 years ago, actually, I began to notice a pattern in my work, which was that a lot of the people that I coach were struggling with something that aligned with imposter syndrome, some version of feeling like they weren't enough, despite their incredible success and outward appearance of being really amazing. Internally, there was a sense that they weren't enough of whatever it was, whether it's not clever enough or not up to the task or whatever. So there was a sort of theme that I noticed that lots of people were struggling with their inner confidence, essentially. And then on the other end of that spectrum, I was working a lot with people who are just swamped with too much to do. So I guess it's part of the territory when you become a leader that you often have a lot of volume and a lot of complexity in your work. But this was sort of felt a bit off the scale, and that it seemed to me that all the sort of resilience theme and well-being stuff was coming into prominence, and I was working a lot in that space with people who were just struggling to find boundaries. So this balance between not enough and too much was very apparent to me in my work. And then, of course, we're in this in a time of climate crisis. So I was thinking, well, what are these big patterns where we seem to feel that we're not enough, we seem to have too much to do, so we can't do enough. And then in the world, we're all crazily over-consuming, and it's as though we can't sort of lose our addiction to having more. And I got really curious about what the theme was. And for me, the theme is enough, our relationship with what is enough, and well, how we can stop.
Funnily enough, as I was speaking or listening to you, I was thinking about the climate change and are we actually doing enough?
Well, yeah. I mean, the ironic thing is that we're not doing enough to address climate change to in order to stop over consuming. And I think that that's also a really interesting way of looking at it, isn't it? That we need to do more. Of course, we do, in order to really look hard at what we're, how we're consuming in the world. We're overshooting planetary boundaries like several times. And what is it in our psychology or in our culture that, that makes that such a complicated or difficult thing to do? It seems so glaringly obvious in one way, and yet we're struggling to do it.
So in your book, you counterpoint, or you put enough in between two poles, is the way I see it. One is excess, too much on one side, doing too many things. And the other side is scarcity, too little. And I feel like both of those are also parts of the challenge. So if I explain it differently, some people are overwhelmed, doing too much. Maybe they don't feel that they are enough. But I also see people who don't have passion, don't have that joie de vivre. They don't have enough of that. And I wonder to what extent there is a population where you see it's more one side or the other. For you, having studied this, how would you react to that?
Yeah, I think that we're all constantly balancing between these two states. And as I heard what you just said, I agree with this sense that often what pushes us to a state of excess is a sense that we lack something. So it's all in this sort of mindset of scarcity, where we lack something, we're not good enough ourselves, so we try and overcompensate and get to these positions of excess. So rather than seeing there are some people who are drawn towards excess or some people who are drawn towards scarcity, I think that actually it's an internal balancing point for each of us. And the reason that I used the image of a set of scales with two things at the end is because it takes us away from a binary where you are either enough or you're not enough, you know, which I think in our world we're very drawn towards binary propositions. And actually what I'm suggesting is that enough is a state in the middle of excess and scarcity, where from which we can flourish. So when we begin to really attend to what a state of enough, where we're able to feel that who we are is enough and we're able to put good boundaries in place so that what we do is enough, that is the point where we find flow and we find ease, from which we can of course then engage with our real passion and our joie de vivre, as you call it. So it's a sort of it's almost a prerequisite position. Once you get into the state of enough, that's the point from which you can really look at what it is you most want to do with your life and how you want to live a fruitful life and make the differences you want to make, because you're not sort of absorbed with or distracted by feeling that you're not enough or just swamped with overcommitments or a lack of boundaries or a sense that you can't quite ever have time of your own.
So I struggle with this concept of balance. I wonder if balance is even possible.
Yeah, the way I see balance is not as a sort of static state, it's a sort of dynamic state. So the image I like is if you try standing on one leg, you're constantly adjusting that. It's a state where you're constantly having to be in awareness and making small little adjustments. So I don't think balance is an endpoint in itself, but I think it's a state from which you can begin to make more choices. But it takes intention, I think. And it takes constant work. So, you know, when we have this idea of living a balanced life, in inverted commas, I mean, that will constantly change according to how we are in each season of our lives, you know. So I like the idea of balance, but I don't think it's a place where we stop. I don't think it's a place of arrival. I think it's a place of continuing adjustment.
Yeah, as you say, it's dynamic. So A funny little side story, of course, as someone who likes languages, enough is probably a hard word for someone who doesn't know English to spell, to pronounce. Mm-hmm. Is it enough or, you know, enough or enough or, but of course the word enough can also be somewhat stigmatized. As you write in the book, it says it represents mediocrity, settling for average, not trying hard. How do you concretely convert that notion, societally imposed mediocrity of compromising between one or other, and making that a powerful torch for your life?
Mm. It's the thing that's the most difficult, really, to counter this idea that. I believe that in our culture, we're so addicted to more is better, or this sort of sense that we've got to drive, constantly strive. And I am trying to reclaim the concept of enough as a sort of jumping off point. So I say in my book, and I believe that that far from being unambitious, enough is actually a place from which we can realize our ambition. So I'm not suggesting that we don't want to grow or achieve amazing things or be creative or do the best, live our best lives. I'm saying that once we can get into a state of enough where we're not preoccupied by what we lack or with too much, that we can get to this place where we go, I am enough. My life is enough, therefore now what do I want to do with my energy and my time, and how can I really flourish? So I suggest that it's moving us away from striving and helping us focus on thriving instead of this constant sort of craving. It's a bit like after you've had a good meal, then you have energy to go out and do your stuff in the day, as opposed to trying to do things constantly, be hungry or fighting for the next thing, you know. So once you've had a great meal and you've digested, then you're ready for the day. This kind of that would be an analogy.
Well, funnily enough, my head goes to I'm ready for a nap, post prandial nap, feeling very satiated, as I hopefully am. So as I was reading your book, and one of the thoughts came to my mind was, to what extent do you believe that we can change? Do you have as a first principle the notion that human beings are able to change, versus our genetic makeup and the things that are kind of preordained via society, education, the way we look, and what God has given us or whomever gave us?
Hmm. Yes, I believe that people can change. I absolutely do. I think that we have so much choice. I think that we are clearly hardwired to be risk aware, alert, as mammals. We share the same sort of nervous systems as pretty much every other mammal on the planet, where we have an amygdala, a sort of fight, flight, freeze response, and we're hardwired to be very attuned to risk for our own survival. But in the 21st century, I think we really need to, we have the opportunity to understand how we can manage that state and not be totally driven by fear, and instead tune into something a bit more generative, like love or abundance, a sense of abundance. And I also, if you take a really big systemic look at our cultures, certainly in the West, over the last 400 years, we've got ourselves into this state of scarcity and therefore striving. But preceding that, there are plenty of ways of living that humans on the planet have and still do, which aren't so addicted to this state of dissatisfaction as a sort of starting point. And so I'm saying, let's really look at that, because it's not serving us. You know, we've taken our planet to the brink of climate collapse, and as a looking at it really big picture, we really need to start to think again about how we are living so that we can leave the planet to our ancestors.
So amongst the trendy concepts that have emerged over the last decades is the Italian wonderful word, far niente, do nothing. And I am not an ADHD, at least certainly never been diagnosed one, but a kind of living my life is as actively and hyper as I have been. I've always looked at far niente as a sort of, whoa, that's way over there. Not able to or not willing to make the change to go over there because probably I have a belief system that says, well, if I stop doing anything, my motion and emotions will just shrivel up, and I won't be aware of how to move back. So one of your art number one, the seven arts, number one starts with mindset. And naturally, I'm a big proponent of looking at mindset, and I love looking at the idea of changing minds. However, if you were to start with mindset, what happens if you get the wrong mindset in the first place? It kind of, everything goes wonky as a result of that. So give us an idea, maybe some of the practical tips that you have with regard to setting the right mindset. How do you concretely get it all on track?
Well, I mean, as you say, there are loads of practices. And I think that one of the things, when you want to try and change your mindset, is to understand this process where the first thing to do is notice what your mindset is or notice what you're thinking. Then once you've got really good at noticing, you can reflect on that. So you notice, you reflect, then you make a choice and reset. So it's a four-stage process. But of course, you have to know what sort of mindset you want and what sort of mindset you have. So listening to the voices in your head, listening to the narrative that you use, the stories that you tell yourself, assumptions that you're making, etc. And then saying, right, are they serving me? Are they the ones that will help me get to where I want to get to in life or help me to live the life I want to lead? And what I notice in my work, but also in my own mindset, my own head, is that so often our mindset takes us to a fear-based position. And what if we replace a sense of fear with a sense of abundance, for example, that we don't hope. Have to be hope. Yeah, lovely. Hope, abundance, a sense that it's going to be okay. And trust that resources are replenishable or that we will have enough of what we need to do what we need to take. And of course, you know, everyone needs a bare minimum. We all need to survive. But I'm talking about sort of once that's achieved, it's more like Maslow's self-actualization, you know. So yes, in terms of how you change your mindset, notice, reflect, choose, reset is the process. And then being very clear and disciplined about what you want to replace your mindset with. And I'm saying an enough mindset is one that's sourced from abundance, not fear, acknowledges what is. So it's not trying to say that everything is sort of motherhood and apple pie. It's saying, you know, let's look at what really is in front of us, what the reality of situations, and remember that all we ever have is the present moment to make choices in, and begin to live in that way. And yeah, when you focus on the present moment and you begin to realize that you've got more choice than you thought. I really believe that people don't make choices, not because they don't know what to do, but because they forget that there are choices to be made, you know.
So you capitalize the word enough in the book. You suggest you want to reclaim the word. I was wondering if there was you talked about what's going on in your own brain. Was there a specific moment or what was the view on your mindset as you were looking into your brain that made you need to reset for you as well? Presumably, I'm thinking that's part of your journey.
Of course, absolutely. I always joke that you write the book you want to read, right? So
love it.
You know, I live in the world of that I'm describing, and you know, I too over the years have struggled with my sense of being enough, and you know, I've been on a journey with that of believing that who I am and the way I want to live my life is worthy of feeling that it is enough for me. So that's great, because that's I've been my own guinea pig in lots of ways. I've had loads of therapy. I've read loads of books around about therapy and coaching and what that takes. And it's led me to sort of philosophy and all sorts of stuff. And of course, I've also driven myself really hard to overwork. And so, yeah, I'm consciously, acutely aware that I'm not sort of trying to preach from a position of, oh, well, I know best. I'm sort of drawing on my own material. And of course, that of the people that I work with. I think that's really, I don't think.
Good material.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think that this is original. I think that we all struggle with this stuff. I mean, I think it's a really, really current issue for people. Yeah, I capitalize enough because I think that if we can just manage to the bit I think we need to reclaim is that actually living within limits can be really useful. It can serve us. So it can be really good to say, do you know what? I've got enough. I don't need to do more. And that can allow you then to do fully what you're trying to do. I mean, like I say, I'm a serial overcommitter, and I have been over the years. So, but when I am able to say, no, do you know what? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to focus really well on one thing that I want to do brilliantly. And that enables a different sort of level of engagement, I think.
The Jim Stroud Podcast explores the discoveries and trends forming the future of our lives. Brain-to-brain communication, robot bosses, microchip implants for workers, and artificial intelligence replacing human workers are all happening now. If you want to know what's happening next, subscribe now to the Jim Stroud Podcast.
So the little story in my head is that there are those who do so much but don't realize that they're overcommitting. And as you said, there are those who feel like they're never enough. I tend to have a rather sexist thought with regard to that. Mm-hmm. That women, in my observation, often feel that they need to do more in order to not be an imposter. And men have so much bravado that they and feel like by doing they are everything, and whereas they kind of tend to we tend to lose touch with who we are. And so my thought is that somehow we need to be more in touch with, when you talk about your reset, about trying to establish, as you write a lot about, your purpose in life. So what are the tips that you have? Because I also find, and I have lots of friends and people I talk with in my life who say, well, actually, I don't have any passion. And I don't know what this purpose is. I kind of satisfied with just doing enough. But it doesn't sound like a very satisfied enough.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I think the whole gender point is a really interesting one, because I think that it's, of course, societally led, you know, this sense that women feel like they've constantly got to do more in order to achieve, and also have to juggle lots of plates, and are usually conventionally the homemakers as well.
They're lead. Definitely the baby makers. There's no argument about that, I think.
For sure. And guys have to, you know, have a lot of status recognition by what they achieve. And, you know, so we're all going, each of us will be coming at it from a different journey is all I mean. And of course, the journey of integration might be a different one. So whether you're coming from a sense that you need to sort of reconnect with your body and your sense of what you really need, as opposed to do, you know, how do you balance that doing and being dynamic? For women to believe that they are enough, you know, maybe that's the journey. Although I have to say there are plenty of men that I've worked with who need that too, and plenty of women that I've worked with who do too much. So, of course, it's hard to generalise. But to your point about purpose, it's a really interesting one that you raise, because you're saying that some people just don't seem to have a sense of purpose or don't have that drive or that sense of clarity around it.
Or any passions. They're like, they're nothing that, you know, yes, they listen to music and yes, they'll watch a series or whatever and have emotions, but it's not the sort of get out of bed and freaking, you know, try, I can't wait to do this again. Oh my God, feeling.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe that's just because people are different, but I the way I describe purpose or think about purpose is I come at it via your sense of values. What is most important to you? And once you've got a clarity around what your values are, what do you most believe in? If you had to choose sort of five words of things that you really believe to be core to who you are, that can help you to identify, therefore, what you're prepared to do in the world or what you want to do in the world. And it might be that for some people, what they want to do in the world is live a quiet life and have a sense of ease and flow. And that for some is others. And what I'm hearing from you is that what you want is a sense of a purpose and direction and achievement. And that's great too for you, but it'll be aligned with your values. And I think the key is to have a sense of integration and a sense of, okay, just awareness actually. Once you get aware of what matters most to you, then you can sort of help focus your life so that what you're doing is what you want to be doing, and is the contribution you're making to the world is one that really matters to you. And usually when you get really into understanding that or thinking about that stuff, it's often the case that it's not just an internal process. It's not just, this is what I want for me. People I know who really connect to their purpose, it's often about, and this is what I want to do for others or want to do in the world or how I get my sense of meaning. And all the research is into psychology is that actually we kind of we feel much more fulfilled and passionate when we are serving our purpose, because it's a connector with us and the world.
So your comments make me think of a couple of previous podcasts, one with Dori Clark, who has just written a book called The Long Game, and she talks about optimizing for interesting as opposed to for purpose, because if you don't have purpose or passion, well, at least optimize for interesting. And I thought that was a really good eye-opening take. And then your comment about values is interesting, because another guest, a guy called Brant Menswar, who wrote the book Black Sheep, talks about the non-negotiable values. And starting from there, and then to your word, integrating them into everything is a really good point, because I've generally sort of led with purpose and then checked my purpose with my values and made sure that they correspond, as opposed to starting with my values and then creating a purpose. So it's lovely to have a toolbox as you look at it. And when you mentioned this idea that we can exist for others and doing things for our community, or I wanted you to make that, tie that up with this notion of being inside out, because I use the term inside out in my last book, but in a different way. And so if you could talk about how the art of enough needs to be inside out, I think the out being the rest of the world in my thoughts.
Yeah. So my premise, and I I don't want this to sound linear, right? I'm not suggesting that you have to do one before the other, because I think, you know, it can be inside out, it can be outside in. But my premise is that when we believe that we are enough, internal, we do the internal work, so we believe that we who we are in the world is enough. And when we then get clear about what it is we want to do and we what we can therefore say no to, so we do enough, then we can start to make our best contribution and connect with having enough. So this sort of be, do, have thing. And that is the biggest challenge in the world right now, is how we are going to manage to live with the climate crisis, in my opinion. I mean, there are loads of big challenges, of course, and equality, etc., is equally important. But actually, in terms of connecting with a purpose, which is really important in terms of survival for the planet, having enough is pretty out there. And so it's really about energy, actually, that because we feel that we are enough and we've got clarity about doing enough, we are able to then connect with the challenges that face the universe and that face the planet, not the universe, and connect with others to do that. And, you know, I'm not suggesting that we all have to focus all our attention on, you know, becoming eco-warriors. You know, we'll each have to find our way with it. But we certainly do need to think hard about how we're living on the planet and over-consuming stuff.
Well, and then there's other things like debt and inflation worries on top of that. So the art of enough, and we've talked a lot about enough. I would love for you, and you talk about it in your book, this notion of the art. And my, let's say, layup is it not about the art of saying no?
To an extent, it's the art of saying no. I mean, saying no is a really important ingredient in the art of enough, definitely, especially if you're somebody who overcommits. And as I've already complained about my own ability to do that. So learning to say no is really important. And I think it's sort of aligned with our sense of how we think about growth in the world, you know, this sort of addiction that we have, or that our economies are based on GDP growth, that we always have to grow, we always have to have more. And I'm saying the art of saying no is to say, no, that's not necessarily the case in terms of growth. We don't have to be bigger in order to be fruitful or grow in. We can grow in different ways. So yes, we need to be able to say no to things that don't matter to us, and we do need to say yes to stuff that really does matter to us. That's absolutely part of it. And that living within limits, healthy limits, where everyone has where we have enough to meet our basic needs, and we are able to then stop doing more than we need, can be such a brilliant place to be, because that's where the art stuff comes in, because it's really creative and enlivening and wonderful.
I love it. So the art is actually this notion of being able to express yourself and have that creative force. Before reading the book, I was thinking about the art as more like sort of some vague idea, you know, as in, well, everybody has their own fingerprint, and therefore it's far more intangible and more difficult. Whereas what you did is you brought a lot of practical tips into it, which, you know, I'm a non-artist, or at least I'm not a painter, I'm a musician, so I guess I am an artist, but there's for me, artistry seems far away, you know, painting, I wouldn't know where to start. And as we were talking about the art of saying no, one of the things I really enjoyed in the tips was your no journal. Can you explain your no journal? I'm not asking you to divulge all of the secrets of the book, but I thought that was a lovely one.
Yeah. Well, the no journal is about just really appreciating how great it is to say no to things. So the no journal is when you write down what you've said no to, you write down what it felt like to say no. And that's important because often we don't say no because we are keen to please other people. So there can be some discomfort in saying no, and writing that down, and it helps you to learn to sort of tolerate it or sort of understand.
Relativize, yeah.
Yeah, quite. And then you write down what saying no enabled you to be able to do. So why did what was the impact of saying no on you? What did it release you to do? So that you're beginning to just make very overt in your own mind the benefits of saying no and what it's enabled for you. Because so often we get caught into this sense that we've got to say yes to things. And that's not, it's A, it's not true, and B, it's not productive, or it might not be serving us well. So the no journal is a process which enables you to reflect on how you said no, what happened in the moment, and what it released you then to do. And it sort of, as you build that sense of doing it over time, you go, oh yes, I did that. That was so worth it. Yes, I'm going to do that again. And it helps you, it's like any habit. It helps you to build up your ability to do it and the confidence to do it because you know it'll be worthwhile.
And assuming one does that, because I've never been good at journaling. I used to write diaries, but then if you go back and read the journals, then you start connecting the dots and seeing patterns and things like, oh, I do a lot of knowing to this type of thing. Mm. I assume there's also a notion of reinforcing the values you do hold dear and finding how that is impacting positively or aligning with who you are and your values.
Yeah, totally. And you know, in order to be able to say no, one of the things you have to get really clear about is what you want to say yes to. Because once you know what you want to say yes to, it makes saying no really much easier, actually. And it's often because we're not massively clear about what we want to say yes to that we say, yeah, we'll do everything. It's a bit like, you know, me writing this book. You know, I had to say no to a whole load of things, but I wanted to say yes to this book to give myself time to write it. So once I got really clear that that was my priority over the last 18 months, it meant that I was much more able to say no, as an example.
When there are some individuals who might say no to anything that's risky, which goes back a little bit to the type of people who are in the scarcity mode, who don't find a joie de vivre. And it's easier to say no, because if I say yes, then I might fail.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, how do you overcome that type of a no, where the amygdala is in full flight or fear mode? To get over that, what do you need to tap into to say yes with that alacrity that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's a great point. I think, again, it comes down to what do you want to do. I mean, it really does. That when we say no out of fear, it's a shutting down no, isn't it? It's a like, oh, no, I can't. It's a sort of, as you say, it comes from a sense of lack or scarcity or fear. And so it can really help to be clear about what you want to do. So what it is you want to say yes to. And that makes it, because often we have to do things that are scary, right? You know, writing a book is scary in some ways. You know, you're putting yourself out there and people will come back with their judgments and their thoughts about it. So actually, it's not suggesting that saying yes is always the easy option, or that it's like, that it's not, it doesn't require huge courage. But the definition of courage is feeling the fear and doing it anyway, right? Mm. It's being brave. So again, a lot of this is noticing. So if you notice yourself saying no to things, the opportunities that because of fear, it's going, ah, oh, okay, I'm in a scarcity mindset when I'm saying no to those things. Is it really true that I don't want to do that stuff? Is it, or is it that I want to that I'm just scared of it? And is my fear so big that I can't overcome it? Or is it something that I could take some steps towards learning to build up my courage for? So again, a lot of this work, especially the inner work, is noticing what your patterns and making a choice about them. Are they enabling you to live the life you want to lead?
So Becky, as a cognitively developed individual as you are, and having thought a lot about this, I wonder to what extent we could invent a class for kids on the art of enough. I have thoughts, or I feel the parent saying, well, that's enough, Johnny. You know, a lot of dampening down that happens at home. And then at school, you've always got to do more. You've got to do better. You know, that you got 72 out of 100. Well, you know, by gum, that means you've got 28 you can do better on. And so there's somehow a systemic need in our society. And yet you don't want to have sort of silver spooned or, you know, non-ambitious kids, because non-ambition, I think, it somehow leads you down the wrong path as well. I mean, yeah, I'll get closed off. I'll be in the scarcity mode. So do you think there's a room for a class? What does that look like? And what should parents be talking about? And how should they be instilling their kids' ability to understand their thought patterns? Because once you're developed, if you're an adult, it's easier, but it might not be so easy for the kid.
Yeah, great. I'd love this to be taught, or for kids to be equipped with a sense that who they are in the world is enough. So of course, anything you can do with kids to help them believe that, yeah, fundamentally who they are is enough, that they're good, that they have inner confidence or inner belief. Yes, tick. In terms of the sort of striving the 72 out of 100, I think that actually what happens is that the education systems get very narrow. So you know, there are certain things in education that allow that we are told are really good, and getting high scores in maths and languages, whatever your language is, or sciences, all that stuff. Great if you're good at that stuff. But what about the people who aren't? What about the kids? So I would say broaden it right out. Help children, help us all to really hone in on what our version of a brilliant life is, whether that be, you know, it's a cliche, but, you know, kicking a football or singing or, you know, being really good at making friends and social. I think, I think we our education systems, I mean, I'm not an educationalist for young people. I kind of feel I'm an educationalist with adults, but I kind of feel like it's a very narrow spectrum that we give ourselves and give our kids. So yeah, teach kids to believe that they're good, that they are enough, and teach them that in order to thrive in the world, they can have a whole host of options. It doesn't just have to be that you're academically successful. And because then we get caught into that loop of that's the only way you can live your life.
So the cheeky thought that's spinning in my head, more is enough. Because we usually like to say less is enough, or less is more. But in this case, it's about having a broader viewpoint, therefore a wider, more points of view.
Yeah, fair point. Yeah. So I'm saying let's widen the lens of what we feel enough is, and let's move away from this very prescriptive linear pathway whereby kids have to be able to achieve in a certain way, which is clearly exclusive to loads of other kids. You know, all you need to do. One of my daughters is dyslexic, and you know,
mine too, by the way.
Yeah. So for her, school wasn't all about achieving top grades and doing that. But you know, she's got a whole load of other skills, and you know, the heartbreak of all of that is that it makes her, because she's not achieving these high scores, she's feeling internally like she's not enough, and then we go round and round and round. So you know,
I do and I live that, and I also hear, and you know, fortunately I'm sort of trying to do the parable of, well, because you're not that way inclined, you're going to find alternative paths, and that alternative style will be very constructive for you. Becky, lovely to have had you on the show. How can someone track you down for purposes of bringing you in to explain what is enough, how to be fulfilled with enough, and of course, how to get your book?
Sure. Well, theartofenough.co.uk will take you to my website. My website is actually under the name of my company, which is called Presence. So you can track me down that way. I'm on social media, The Art of Enough, Becky Hall, and Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, all the usuals. And you can buy my book from any good bookshop or bookseller. It's on Amazon. It's Waterstones in the UK. There's a bookseller called Waterstones, but you know, anywhere will sell it. I've heard today that someone I know in Brazil's just ordered it, so Amazon's sending it out there too. Please do get in touch if you want to conversation. I'm really keen for this to become a conversation or something that we start talking about and thinking about, and I'm very happy to engage with people if they wanted to get in touch with me via my website. It's probably the quickest way, but any of the socials too.
Lovely. Becky, thank you so much.
You're really welcome. It's been a delight talking to you.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show, would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready, fire and arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Thank you.
Imagine how fast we could solve the world's biggest problems if more SaaS startups would gain traction sooner. Welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. This podcast is dedicated to sharing experiences from B2B SaaS CEOs who are going above and beyond to deliver change that is noticed. You will hear their secrets and learn what is required to build a SaaS business that the world starts talking about and keeps talking about, and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so.